and craving must contend with the cerebral restraints of prudence, moralization, and self-control. Though as in all attempts at taming the wild, it's not always clear who has the upper hand. Within the frontal lobes, one can readily see how the orbital cortex got its name. It is a big, spherical dent that accommodates the bony socket of the eye. Scientists have known that the orbital cortex is involved with regulating the emotions since 1848, when a railroad foreman named Phineas Gage tamped down some blasting powder in a hole in a rock and ignited an explosion that sent the tamping iron up through his cheekbone and out the top of his skull. A 20th century computer reconstruction based on the holes in the skull suggests that the spike tore up his left orbital cortex together with the ventromedial cortex on the inside wall of the cerebrum. The orbital and ventromedial cortex are continuous, wrapping around the bottom edge of the frontal lobe, and neuroscientists often use either term to refer to the combination of the two of them. Though Gage's senses, memories, and movement were intact, it soon became clear that the damaged parts of his brain had been doing something important. Here is how his physician described the change. The equilibrium or balance, so to speak, between his intellectual faculties and animal propensities seems to have been destroyed. He is fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanity, which was not previously his custom, manifesting but little deference for his fellows, impatient of restraint or advice when it conflicts with his desires, at times pertinaciously obstinate, yet capricious and vacillating, devising many plans of future operations which are no sooner arranged than they are abandoned in turn for others, appearing more feasible. A child in his intellectual capacity and manifestations, he has the animal passions of a strong man. Previous to his injury, although untrained in the schools, he possessed a well-balanced mind and was looked upon by those who knew him as a shrewd, smart businessman, very energetic and persistent in executing all his plans of operation. In this regard, his mind was radically changed, so decidedly that his friends and acquaintances said he was no longer Gage. Though Gage eventually recovered much of his equipoise, and the story has been embellished and sometimes garbled in generations of retelling to introductory psychology students, today our understanding of the function of the orbital cortex is broadly consistent with the doctor's description. The orbital cortex is strongly connected to the amygdala, hypothalamus, and other parts of the brain involved with emotion. It is suffused with neurons that use dopamine as their neurotransmitter and that are connected to the seeking system in the striatum. It is adjacent to an island of cortex called the insula, the front of which just barely peeks out from beneath the Sylvian fissure. The rest of the insula extends back under that fissure, obscured by overhanging flaps of the frontal and temporal lobes. The insula registers our physical gut feelings, including the sensation of a distended stomach and other inner states like nausea, warmth, a full bladder, and a pounding heart. The brain takes metaphors like, "That makes my blood boil," and "His behavior disgusts me," literally. The cognitive neuroscientist Jonathan Cohen and his team found that when a person feels he is getting a raw deal from another person who is dividing a windfall between them, the insula is fired up. When the stingy allocation is thought to come from a computer, so there's no one to get mad at, the insula remains dark. The orbital cortex resting on the eyeballs and the ventromedial cortex facing inward are, as mentioned, adjacent, and it's not easy to distinguish what they do, which is why neuroscientists often lump them together. The orbital cortex seems to be more involved with determining whether an experience is pleasant or unpleasant, benefiting its position next to the insula with its input from the viscera, while the ventromedial cortex is more involved with determining whether you are getting what you want and avoiding what you don't want, benefiting its position along the midline of the brain, where the seeking circuit extends. The distinction may carry over to a difference in the moral realm between an emotional reaction to a harm and judgment and reflection on it. But the dividing line is fuzzy, and I'll continue to use orbital to refer to both parts of the brain. The inputs to the orbital cortex, gut feelings, objects of desire, and emotional impulses, together with sensations and memories from other parts of the cortex, allow it to serve as the regulator of emotional life. Visceral feelings of anger, warmth, fear, and disgust are combined with the person's goals, and modulating signals are computed and sent back down to the emotional structures from which they originated. Signals are also sent upward to regions of the cortex that carry out cool deliberation and executive control. This flowchart, suggested by the neuroanatomy, corresponds fairly well with what psychologists see in the clinic and lab. Making allowances for the difference between the flowery language of medical reports in the 19th century and the clinical jargon of the 21st, today's descriptions of patients with damage to their orbital cortex could have applied to Phineas Gage. Disinhibited, socially inappropriate, susceptible to misinterpreting others' moods, impulsive, unconcerned with the consequences of their actions, irresponsible in everyday life, lacking an insight into the seriousness of their condition, and prone to weak initiative. The psychologists Angela Scarpa and Adrian Rain offer a similar list, but with an additional symptom at the end that is relevant to our discussion. Argumentativeness, lack of concern for consequences of behavior, loss of social graces, impulsivity, distractibility, shallowness, lability, violence. The extra noun came from Rain's own studies, which, instead of selecting patients with orbital brain damage and then examining their personalities, selected people prone to violence and then examined their brains. He focused on people with antisocial personality disorder, defined by the American Psychiatric Association as a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others, including lawbreaking, deceit, aggressiveness, recklessness, and lack of remorse. People with antisocial personality disorder make up a large proportion of violent felons, and a subset of them who possess glibness, narcissism, grandiosity, and a superficial charm are called psychopaths, or sometimes sociopaths. Rain scanned the brains of violence-prone people with antisocial personality disorder and found that the orbital regions were shrunken and less metabolically active, as were other parts of the emotional brain, including the amygdala. In one experiment, Rain compared the brains of prisoners who had committed an impulsive murder with those who had killed with premeditation. Only the impulsive murderers showed a malfunction in their orbital cortex, suggesting that the self-control implemented by this part of the brain is a major inhibitor of violence. But another part of its job description may come into play as well. Monkeys with lesions in the orbital cortex have trouble fitting into dominance hierarchies, and they get into more fights. Not coincidentally, humans with orbital damage are insensitive to social faux pas. When they hear a story about a woman who inadvertently disparaged a gift she received from a friend, or accidentally divulged that the friend had been excluded from a party list, the patients fail to recognize that anyone had said anything wrong, and don't realize that the friend might have been hurt. Rain found that when people with antisocial personality disorder were asked to compose and deliver a speech about their own faults, which for ordinary people is a nerve-wracking ordeal accompanied by embarrassment, shame, and guilt, their nervous systems were unresponsive. The orbital cortex, then, together with its ventromedial neighbor, is involved in several of the pacifying faculties of the human mind, including self-control, sympathy to others, and sensitivity to norms and conventions. For all that, the orbital cortex is a fairly primitive part of the cerebrum. We saw it in the lowly rat, and its inputs are literally and figuratively from the gut. The more deliberative and intellectual modulators of violence rely on other parts of the brain. Consider the process of deciding whether to punish someone who has caused a harm. Our sense of justice tells us that the perpetrator's culpability depends not just on the harm done, but on his or her mental state. The mens rea, or guilty mind, that is necessary for an act to be considered a crime in most legal systems. Suppose a woman kills her husband by putting rat poison in his tea. Our decision as to whether to send her to the electric chair very much depends on whether the container she spooned it out of was mislabeled domino sugar or correctly labeled Decon kills rats. That is, whether she knew she was poisoning him and wanted him dead, or it was all a tragic accident. A brute emotional reflex to the actus reus, the bad act. She killed her husband. Shame! Could trigger an urge for retribution regardless of her intention. The crucial role played by the perpetrator's mental state in our assignment of blame is what makes the moralization gap possible. Victims insist that the perpetrator deliberately and knowingly wanted to harm them, while the perpetrators insist that the harm was unintended. The psychologists Leanne Young and Rebecca Sachs put people in an fMRI scanner and had them read stories involving deliberate and accidental harms. They found that the ability to exculpate harmdoers in the light of their mental state depends on the part of the brain at the junction between the temporal and parietal lobes, though it's actually the counterpart of this region in the right hemisphere that lit up in the study. The temporoparietal junction sits at a crossroads for many kinds of information, including the perception of the position of one's own body and the perception of the bodies and actions of other people. Sachs had previously shown that the region is necessary for the mental faculty that has been called mentalizing, intuitive psychology, and theory of mind, namely the ability to understand the beliefs and desires of another person. There is another kind of moral deliberation that goes beyond the gut, weighing the consequences of different courses of action. Consider the old chestnut from moral philosophy. A family is hiding from the Nazis in a cellar. Should they smother their baby to prevent it from crying and giving away their location, which would result in the deaths of everyone in the family, baby included? How about throwing a fat man in front of a runaway trolley so that his bulk will stop it before it slams into five workers on the track? A utilitarian calculus would say that both killings are permissible because they would sacrifice one life to save five. Yet many people would balk at smothering the baby or heaving the fat man, presumably because they have a visceral reaction against harming an innocent person with their bare hands. In a logically equivalent dilemma, a bystander to the runaway trolley could save the five workers by diverting it onto a sidetrack, where it would kill just one. In this version, everyone agrees that it's permissible to throw the switch and save five lives at a cost of one, presumably because it doesn't feel like you're really killing anyone. You're just failing to prevent the trolley from doing it. The philosopher Joshua Green, working with Cohen and others, has shown that the visceral reaction against smothering the baby or throwing the man in front of the train comes from the amygdala and orbital cortex, whereas the utilitarian thinking that would save the greatest number of lives is computed in a part of the frontal lobe called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. The dorsolateral cortex is the part of the brain that is most involved in intellectual abstract problem solving. It lights up, for example, when people do the problems on an IQ test. When people consider the case of the crying baby in the cellar, both their orbital cortex, which reacts to the horror of smothering the baby, and their dorsolateral cortex, which calculates lives saved and lost, light up, together with a third part of the brain that deals with conflicting impulses, the anterior cingulate cortex in the medial wall of the brain. The people who deduce that it's all right to smother the baby show greater activation in the dorsolateral cortex. The temporoparietal junction and dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which grew tremendously over the course of evolution, give us the wherewithal to perform cool calculations that deem certain kinds of violence justifiable. Our ambivalence about the outputs of those calculations, whether smothering the baby should be thought of as an act of violence or an act that prevents violence, shows that the quintessentially cerebral parts of the cerebrum are neither inner demons nor better angels. They are cognitive tools that can both foster violence and inhibit it. And as we shall see, both powers are exuberantly employed in the distinctively human forms of violence. My brief tour of the neurobiology of violence barely does justice to our scientific understanding, and our scientific understanding barely does justice to the phenomena themselves. But I hope it has persuaded you that violence does not have a single psychological root, but a number of them, working by different principles. To understand them, we need to look not just at the hardware of the brain, but also at its software. That is, at the reasons people engage in violence. Those reasons are implemented as intricate patterns in the microcircuitry of brain tissue. We cannot read them directly from the neurons, any more than we can understand a movie by putting a DVD under a microscope. So the remainder of the chapter will shift to the bird's-eye view of psychology, while connecting the psychological phenomena to the neuroanatomy. There are many taxonomies of violence, and they tend to make similar distinctions. I will adapt a four-part scheme from Baumeister, splitting one of his categories in two. The first category of violence may be called practical, instrumental, exploitative, or predatory. It is the simplest kind of violence, the use of force as a means to an end. The violence is deployed in pursuit of a goal such as greed, lust, or ambition, which is set up by the seeking system and is guided by the entirety of the person's intelligence, for which the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is a convenient symbol. The second root of violence is dominance, the drive for supremacy over one's rivals. Baumeister calls it egotism. This drive may be tied to the testosterone-fueled dominance or intermale aggression system, though it is by no means confined to males or even to individual people. As we shall see, groups compete for dominance too. The third root of violence is revenge, the drive to pay back a harm in kind. Its immediate engine is the rage system, but it can recruit the seeking system to its cause as well. The fourth root is sadism, the joy of hurting. This motive, puzzling and horrifying in equal measure, may be a byproduct of several quirks of our psychology, particularly the seeking system. The fifth and most consequential cause of violence is ideology, in which true believers weave a collection of motives into a creed and recruit other people to carry out its destructive goals. An ideology cannot be identified with a part of the brain or even with a whole brain because it is distributed across the brains of many people. Predation. The first category of violence is not really a category at all because its perpetrators have no destructive motive like hate or anger. They simply take the shortest path to something they want, and a living thing happens to be in the way. At best, it is a category by exclusion, the absence of any inhibiting factor like sympathy or moral concern. When Immanuel Kant stated the second formulation of his categorical imperative, that an act is moral if it treats a person as an end in itself and not as a means to an end, he was in effect defining morality as the avoidance of this kind of violence. Predation may also be called exploitative, instrumental, or practical violence. It coincides with Hobbes's first cause of a quarrel, to invade for gain. It is Dawkins's survival machine treating another survival machine as a part of its environment, like a rock or a river or a lump of food. It is the interpersonal equivalent of Clausewitz's dictum that war is merely the continuation of policy by other means. It is Willie Sutton's answer to the question of why he robbed banks, because that's where the money is. It lies beneath the advice of a farmer to increase a horse's efficiency by castrating it with two bricks. When asked, "Doesn't that hurt?" the farmer replies, "Not if you keep your thumbs out of the way." Because predatory violence is just a means to a goal, it comes in as many varieties as there are human goals. The paradigm case is literal predation, hunting for food or sport, because it involves no animosity toward the victim. Far from hating their quarry, hunters valorize and totemize them, from Paleolithic cave paintings to trophies above the mantles in gentlemen's clubs. Hunters may even empathize with their prey, proof that empathy alone is not a bar to violence. The ecologist Louis Liebenberg studied the remarkable ability of the Ungsan to infer the whereabouts and physical condition of their game from a few faint tracks as they pursue them across the Kalahari Desert. They do it with empathy, putting themselves in the hooves of the animal and imagining what it is feeling and where it is tempted to flee. There may even be an element of love. One night, after the ninth inning of a baseball game, I was too comatose to get off the couch or even change the channel, and passively watched the following program on the cable sports network. It was a show about fishing, and consisted entirely of footage of a middle-aged man in an aluminum boat on a nondescript stretch of water, pulling in one large bass after another. With each catch, he brought the fish close to his face and stroked it, making little kissy noises and cooing, "Ooh, aren't you a beauty? You're a pretty one. Yes, you are." The chasm between the perpetrator's perspective, amoral, pragmatic, even frivolous, and the victim's is nowhere wider than in our predation of animals. It's safe to say that the bass, if given the chance, would not reciprocate the fisherman's affection, and most people would not want to know the opinion of a broiler chicken or a live lobster on whether the mild pleasure we get from eating their flesh, rather than a plate of eggplant, justifies the sacrifice they will make. The same incuriosity enables cold-hearted predatory violence against humans. Here are a few examples. Romans suppressing provincial rebellions, Mongols raising cities that resist their conquest, free companies of demobilized soldiers plundering and raping, colonial settlers expelling or massacring indigenous peoples, gangsters whacking a rival, an informant, or an uncooperative official, rulers assassinating a political opponent or vice versa, governments jailing or executing dissidents, warring nations bombing enemy cities, hoodlums injuring a victim who resists a robbery or carjacking, criminals killing an eyewitness to a crime, mothers smothering a newborn baby they feel they cannot raise, defensive and preemptive violence, doing it to them before they do it to you, is also a form of instrumental violence. Predatory violence may be the most extraordinary and perplexing phenomenon in the human moral landscape, precisely because it is so mundane and explicable. We read of an atrocity, say, rebel soldiers encamped on a rooftop in Uganda who passed the time by kidnapping women, tying them up, raping them, and throwing them to their deaths. Shake our heads and ask, how could people do these things? We refuse to accept obvious answers like boredom, lust, or sport, because the suffering of the victim is so obscenely disproportionate to the benefit to the perpetrator. We take the victim's point of view and advert to a conception of pure evil. Yet to understand these outrages, we might be better off asking not why they happen, but why they don't happen more often. With the possible exception of Jain priests, all of us engage in predatory violence, if only against insects. In most cases, the temptation to prey on humans is inhibited by emotional and cognitive restraints, but in a minority of individuals, these restraints are absent. Psychopaths make up 1-3% of the male population, depending on whether one uses the broad definition of antisocial personality disorder, which embraces many kinds of callous troublemakers, or a narrower definition that picks out the more cunning manipulators. Psychopaths are liars and bullies from the time they are children, show no capacity for sympathy or remorse, make up 20-30% of violent criminals, and commit half the serious crimes. They also perpetrate nonviolent crimes like bilking elderly couples out of their life savings and running a business with ruthless disregard for the welfare of the workforce or stakeholders. As we saw, the regions of the brain that handle social emotions, especially the amygdala and orbital cortex, are relatively shrunken or unresponsive in psychopaths, though they may show no other signs of pathology. In some people, signs of psychopathy develop after damage to these regions from disease or an accident, but the condition is also partly heritable. Psychopathy may have evolved as a minority strategy that exploits a large population of trusting cooperators. Though no society can stock its militias and armies exclusively with psychopaths, such men are bound to be disproportionately attracted to these adventures, with their prospect of plunder and rape. As we saw in Chapter 6, genocides and civil wars often involve a division of labor between the ideologues or warlords who run them and the shock troops, including some number of psychopaths who are happy to carry them out. The psychology of predatory violence consists in the human capacity for means-end reasoning, and the fact that our faculties of moral restraint do not kick in automatically in our dealings with every living thing. But there are two psychological twists in the way that predatory violence is carried out. The predatory violence is purely practical. The human mind does not stick to abstract reasoning for long. It tends to backslide into evolutionarily prepared and emotionally charged categories. As soon as the objects being preyed upon take protective measures in response, emotions are likely to run high. The human prey may hide and regroup, or they may fight back, perhaps even threatening to destroy the predator preemptively, a kind of instrumental violence of their own that gives rise to a security dilemma or Hobbesian trap. In these cases, the predator's state of mind may shift from dispassionate means-ends analysis to disgust, hatred, and anger. As we have seen, perpetrators commonly analogize their victims to vermin and treat them with moralized disgust. Or they may see them as existential threats and treat them with hatred, the emotion that, as Aristotle noted, consists of a desire not to punish an adversary, but to end its existence. When extermination is not feasible and perpetrators have to continue to deal with their victims, either directly or with the participation of third parties, they may treat them with anger. The predators may respond to the defensive reprisals of their prey as if they were the ones under attack, and experience a moralized wrath and a thirst for revenge. Thanks to the moralization gap, they will minimize their own first strike as necessary and trivial, while magnifying the reprisal as unprovoked and devastating. Each side will count the wrongs differently, the perpetrator tallying an even number of strikes and the victim an odd number, and the difference in arithmetic can stoke a spiral of revenge, a dynamic we will explore in a later section. There is a second way self-serving biases can fan a small flame of predatory violence into an inferno. People exaggerate not just their moral rectitude, but their power and prospects, a subtype of self-serving bias called positive illusions. Hundreds of studies have shown that people overrate their health, leadership ability, intelligence, professional competence, sporting prowess, and managerial skills. People also hold the nonsensical belief that they are inherently lucky. Most people think they are more likely than the average person to attain a good first job, to have gifted children, and to live to a ripe old age. They also think that they are less likely than the average person to be the victim of an accident, crime, disease, depression, unwanted pregnancy, or earthquake. Why should people be so deluded? Positive illusions make people happier, more confident, and mentally healthier. But that cannot be the explanation for why they exist, because it only begs the question of why our brains should be designed so that the only unrealistic assessments make us happy and confident, as opposed to calibrating our contentment against reality. The most plausible explanation is that positive illusions are a bargaining tactic, a credible bluff. In recruiting an ally to support you in a risky venture, in bargaining for the best deal, or in intimidating an adversary into backing down, you stand to gain if you credibly exaggerate your strengths. Believing your own exaggeration is better than cynically lying about it, because the arms race between lying and lie detection has equipped your audience with the means of seeing through barefaced lies. As long as your exaggerations are not laughable, your audience cannot afford to ignore your self-assessment altogether, because you have more information about yourself than anyone else does, and you have a built-in incentive not to distort your assessment too much, or you would constantly blunder into disasters. It would be better for the species if no one exaggerated, but our brains were not selected for the benefit of the species, and no individual can afford to be the only honest one in a community of self-enhancers. Overconfidence makes the tragedy of predation even worse. If people were completely rational, they would launch an act of predatory aggression only if they were likely to succeed, and only if the spoils of the success exceeded the losses they would incur in the fighting. By the same token, the weaker party should concede as soon as the outcome was a foregone conclusion. A world with rational actors might see plenty of exploitation, but it should not see many fights or wars. Violence would come about only if the two parties were so closely matched that a fight was the only way to determine who was stronger. But in a world with positive illusions, an aggressor may be emboldened to attack, and a defender emboldened to resist, well out of proportion to their odds of success. As Winston Churchill noted, "Always remember, however sure you are, that you can easily win, that there would not be a war if the other man did not think he also had a chance." The result can be wars of attrition, in both the game theoretic and military sense, which, as we saw in Chapter 5, are among the most destructive events in history. Military historians have long noted that leaders make decisions in war that are reckless to the point of delusion. The invasions of Russia by Napoleon, and more than a century later by Hitler, are infamous examples. Over the past five centuries, countries that initiated wars have ended up losing them between a quarter and a half of the time, and when they won the victories were often pyrrhic. Richard Wrangham, inspired by Barbara Tuchman's The March of Folly from Troy to Vietnam, and by Robert Trivers's theory of self-deception, suggested that military incompetence is often a matter not of insufficient data or mistakes in strategy, but of overconfidence. Leaders overestimate their prospects of winning. Their bravado may rally the troops and intimidate weaker adversaries, but also may put them on a collision course with an enemy who is not as weak as they think and who may be under the spell of an overconfidence of its own. The political scientist Dominic Johnson, working with Wrangham and others, conducted an experiment to test the idea that mutual overconfidence could lead to war. They ran a moderately complicated war game in which pairs of participants pretended to be national leaders who had opportunities to negotiate with, threaten, or mount a costly attack on each other in competition for diamonds in a disputed border region. The winner of the contest was the player who had more money, if their nation survived at all, at the end of several rounds of play. The players interacted with each other by computer and could not see each other, so the men didn't know whether they were playing with another man or with a woman, and vice versa. Before they began, participants were asked to predict how well they would do relative to everyone else playing the game. The experimenters got a nice, like, woebegone effect. A majority thought they would do better than average. Now, in any like woebegone effect, it's possible that not many people really are self-deceived. Suppose 70% of people say they are better than average. Since half of any population really is above average, perhaps only 20% think too well of themselves. That was not the case in the war game. The more confident a player was, the worse he or she did. Confident players launched more unprovoked attacks, especially when playing each other, which triggered mutually destructive retaliation in subsequent rounds. It will come as no surprise to women that the overconfident and mutually destructive pairs of players were almost exclusively men. To evaluate the overconfidence theory in the real world, it's not enough to notice in hindsight that certain military leaders proved to be mistaken. It has to be shown that at the time of making a fateful decision, a leader had access to information that would have convinced a disinterested party that the venture would probably fail. In Overconfidence and War, The Havoc and Glory of Positive Illusions, Johnson vindicated Wrangham's hypothesis by looking at the predictions made by leaders on the verge of war and showing that they were unrealistically optimistic and contradicted by information available to them at the time. In the weeks preceding World War I, for example, the leaders of England, France, and Russia on one side, and of Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire on the other, all predicted that the war would be a rout and their victorious troops would be home by Christmas. Ecstatic crowds of young men on both sides poured out of their homes to enlist, not because they were altruists eager to die for their country, but because they didn't think they were going to die. They couldn't all be right, and they weren't. In Vietnam, three American administrations escalated the war despite ample intelligence telling them that victory at an unacceptable cost was unlikely. Destructive wars of attrition, Johnson points out, needn't require that both sides be certain or even highly confident of prevailing. All it takes is that the subjective probabilities of the adversaries sum to a value greater than one. In modern conflicts, he notes, where the fog of war is particularly thick and the leadership removed from the facts on the ground, overconfidence can survive longer than it would have in the small-scale battles in which our positive illusions evolved. Another modern danger is that the leadership of nations is likely to go to men who are well into the region of overconfidence. Johnson expected that wars stoked by overconfidence should be less common in democracies, where the flow of information is more likely to expose the illusions of leaders to cold splashes of reality. But he found that it was the flow of information itself, rather than just the existence of a democratic system, that made the difference. Johnson published his book in 2004, and the choice of an image for the cover was a no-brainer. The famous 2003 photograph of a flight-suited George W. Bush on the deck of an aircraft carrier festooned with the banner, "Mission Accomplished." Overconfidence did not undermine the conduct of the Iraq War itself, other than for Saddam Hussein, of course, but it was fatal to the post-war goal of bringing stable democracy to Iraq, which the Bush administration catastrophically failed to plan for. The political scientist Karen Alter conducted an analysis before the war broke out, showing that the Bush administration was unusually closed in its decision-making process. In a textbook illustration of the phenomenon of groupthink, the pre-war policy team believed in its own infallibility and virtue, shut out contradictory assessments, enforced consensus, and self-censored private doubts. Just before the Iraq War, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld observed, "There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know we don't know." Johnson, following a remark by the philosopher Slavoj Žižek, notes that Rumsfeld omitted a crucial fourth category, the unknown knowns, things that are known, or at least could be known, but are ignored or suppressed. It was the unknown knowns that allowed a moderate amount of instrumental violence, a few weeks of shock and awe, to unleash an open-ended exchange of every other kind of violence. Dominance. The colorful idioms, chest thumping, having a chip on his shoulder, drawing a line in the sand, throwing down the gauntlet, and pissing contest, all denote an action that is inherently meaningless but provokes a contest for dominance. That is a sign that we are dealing with a category that is very different from predatory, practical, or instrumental violence. Even though nothing tangible is at stake in contests for dominance, they are among the deadliest forms of human quarrel. At one end of the magnitude scale, we have seen that many wars in the age of dynasties, sovereignty, and nationalism were fought over nebulous claims to national preeminence, including World War I. At the other end of the scale, the single largest motive for homicide is altercations of relatively trivial origin, insult, curse, jostling, etc. In their book on homicide, Martin Daly and Margot Wilson advise that the participants in these trivial altercations behave as if a great deal more is at issue than small change or access to a pool table, and their evaluations of what is at stake deserve our respectful consideration. Contests of dominance are not as ridiculous as they seem. In any zone of anarchy, an agent can protect its interests only by cultivating a reputation for a willingness and an ability to defend itself against depredations. Though this mettle can be demonstrated in retaliation after the fact, it's better to flaunt it provocatively before any damage is done. To prove that one's implicit threats are not hot air, it may be necessary to seek theaters in which one's resolve and retaliatory capacity can be displayed, a way to broadcast the message, "Don't fuck with me." Everyone has an interest in knowing the relative fighting abilities of the agents in their midst, because all parties have an interest in preempting any fight whose outcome is a foregone conclusion, and that would needlessly bloody both fighters if carried out. When the relative prowesses of the members of a community are stable and widely known, we call it a dominance hierarchy. Dominance hierarchies are based on more than brute strength. Since not even the baddest primate can win a fight of 1 against 3, dominance depends on the ability to recruit allies, who in turn don't choose their teammates at random, but join up with the stronger and shrewder ones. The commodity that is immediately at stake in contests of dominance is information, and that feature differentiates dominance from predation in several ways. One is that while contests of dominance can escalate into lethal clashes, especially when the contestants are closely matched and intoxicated with positive illusions, most of the time, in humans and animals alike, they are settled with displays. The antagonists flaunt their strength, brandish their weapons, and play games of brinkmanship. The contest ends when one side backs down. With predation, in contrast, the only point is to obtain an object of desire. Another implication of the informational stakes in contests of dominance is that the violence is interwoven with exchanges of data. Reputation is a social construction that is built on what logicians call common knowledge. To avert a fight, a pair of rivals must not only know who is stronger, but each must know that the other knows, and must know that the other knows that he knows, and so on. Common knowledge may be undermined by a contrary opinion, and so contests of dominance are fought in arenas of public information. They may be sparked by an insult, particularly in cultures of honor, and in those that sanction formal dueling. The insult is treated like a physical injury or theft, and it sets off an urge for violent revenge, which can make the psychology of dominance blend into the psychology of revenge discussed in the next section. Studies of American street violence have found that the young men who endorse a code of honor are the ones most likely to commit an act of serious violence in the following year. They also have found that the presence of an audience doubles the likelihood that an argument between two men will escalate to violence. When dominance is reckoned within a closed group, it is a zero-sum game. If someone's rank goes up, another's has to go down. Dominance tends to erupt in violence within small groups like gangs and isolated workplaces, where a person's rank within the clique determines the entirety of his social worth. If people belong to many groups and can switch in and out of them, they are more likely to find one in which they are esteemed, and an insult or slight is less consequential. Since the only commodity at stake in contests of dominance is information, once the point has been made about who's the boss, the violence can come to an end without setting off rounds of vendetta. The primatologist Franz de Waal discovered that in most primate species, after two animals have fought, they will reconcile. They may touch hands, kiss, embrace, and in the case of bonobos, have sex. This makes one wonder why they bother to fight in the first place if they were just going to make up afterward, and why they make up afterward if they had reason to fight. The reason is that reconciliation occurs only among primates whose long-term interests are bound together. The ties that bind may be genetic relatedness, collective defense against predators, being in cahoots against a third party, or, in an experiment, getting fed only if they work together. The overlap of interest is not perfect, so they still have reason to fight for dominance or retaliation within the group, but it is not zero, so they cannot afford to smack each other around indefinitely, let alone kill each other. Among primates whose interests are not bound up in any of these ways, adversaries are unforgiving, and violence is likelier to escalate. Chimpanzees, for example, reconcile after a fight within their community, but they never reconcile after a battle or raid with members of a different community. As we shall see in the next chapter, reconciliation among humans is also governed by the perception of common interests. The metaphor of competitive distance urination suggests that the gender with the equipment best suited to competing is the gender that is most likely to participate in contests of dominance. Though in many primate species, including humans, both sexes jockey for preeminence usually against members of their own sex, it seems to loom larger in the minds of men than in the minds of women, taking on a mystical status as a priceless commodity worth almost any sacrifice. Surveys of personal values in men and women find that the men assign a lopsided value to professional status compared to all the other pleasures of life. They take greater risks, and they show more confidence and more overconfidence. Most labor economists consider these sex differences to be a contributor to the gender gap in earnings and professional success. And men are, of course, by far the more violent sex. Though the exact ratios vary, in every society it is the males more than the females who play fight, bully, fight for real, carry weapons, enjoy violent entertainment, fantasize about killing, kill for real, rape, start wars, and fight in wars. Not only is the direction of the sex difference universal, but the first domino is almost certainly biological. The difference is found in most other primates, emerges in toddlerhood, and may be seen in boys who, because of anomalous genitalia, are secretly raised as girls. We have already seen why the sex difference evolved. Mammalian males can reproduce more quickly than females, so they compete for sexual opportunities, while females tilt their priorities toward ensuring the survival of themselves and their offspring. Men have more to gain in violent competition, and also less to lose, because fatherless children are more likely to survive than motherless ones. That does not mean that women avoid violence altogether. Chuck Berry speculated that Venus de Milo lost both her arms in a wrestling match over a brown-eyed, handsome man. But they find it less appealing. Women's competitive tactics consist in less physically perilous relational aggression, such as gossip and ostracism. In theory, violent competition for males and violent competition for dominance needn't go together. One doesn't have to invoke dominance to explain why Genghis Khan inseminated so many women that his Y chromosome is common in Central Asia today. It's enough to observe that he killed the women's fathers and husbands. But given that social primates regulate violence by deferring to dominant individuals, dominance and mating success in practice went hand in hand during most of our species' history. In non-state societies, dominant men have more wives, more girlfriends, and more affairs with other men's wives. In the six earliest empires, the correlation between status and mating success can be quantified precisely. Laura Betzig found that emperors often had thousands of wives and concubines, princes had hundreds, noblemen had dozens, upper-class men had up to a dozen, and middle-class men had three or four. It follows mathematically that many lower-class men had none, and thus a strong incentive to fight their way out of the lower class. Recently, with the advent of reliable contraception and the demographic transition, the correlation has been weakened. But wealth, power, and professional success still increase a man's sex appeal, and the most visible clue to physical dominance, height, still gives a man an edge in economic, political, and romantic competition. Whereas instrumental violence deploys the seeking and calculating parts of the brain, dominance deploys the system that Panksepp calls intermale aggression. It really should be called intrasexual competition, because it is found in women too, and the human habit of male parental investment means that women as well as men have an evolutionary incentive to compete for mates. Still, at least one part of the circuit, a nucleus in the anterior preoptic portion of the hypothalamus, is twice as large in men as it is in women, and the entire system is studded with receptors for testosterone, which is about 5 to 10 times more plentiful in the bloodstream of men than of women. The hypothalamus, recall, controls the pituitary gland, which can secrete a hormone that tells the testes or the adrenal glands to produce more testosterone. Though testosterone is often identified in the popular imagination as the cause of male pugnacity, the substance that drives men to behave with quintessential guyness, to posture, push, yelp, belch, punch, and play air guitar, as the journalist Natalie Angier put it, biologists have been nervous about blaming it for male aggression itself. Raising testosterone undoubtedly makes most birds and mammals more obstreperous, and lowering it makes them less so, as the owner of any neutered dog or cat is aware. But in humans, the effects are less easily measured, for a number of boring biochemical reasons, and they are less directly tied to aggression, for an interesting psychological reason. Testosterone, according to scientists' best guess, does not make men more aggressive across the board, but prepares them for a challenge of dominance. In chimpanzees, testosterone goes up in the presence of a sexually receptive female, and it is correlated with the male's dominance rank, which in turn is correlated with his aggressiveness. In men, testosterone levels rise in the presence of an attractive female and in anticipation of competition with other men, such as in sports. Once a match has begun, testosterone rises even more, and when the match has been decided, testosterone continues to rise in the winner, but not in the loser. Men who have higher levels of testosterone play more aggressively, have angrier faces during competition, smile less often, and have firmer handshakes. In experiments, they are more likely to lock their gaze onto an angry face and to perceive a neutral face as angry. It's not just fun and games that pump up the hormone. Recall that the Southern men who were insulted in Richard Nisbet's experiment on the psychology of honor responded with a rise in testosterone, and that they looked angrier, shook hands more firmly, and walked out of the lab with more of a swagger. At the tail end of the belligerence spectrum, prisoners with higher levels of testosterone have been found to commit more acts of violence. Testosterone rises in adolescence and young adulthood and declines in middle age. It also declines when men get married, have children, and spend time with their children. The hormone, then, is an internal regulator of the fundamental trade-off between parenting effort and mating effort, where mating effort consists both in wooing the opposite sex and in fending off rivals of the same sex. Testosterone may be the knob that turns men into dads or cads. The rise and fall of testosterone over the lifespan correlates, more or less, with the rise and fall of male pugnacity. Incidentally, the first law of violence, it's something that young men do, is easier to document than to explain. Though it's clear why men should have evolved to be more violent than women, it's not so clear why young men should be more violent than old men. After all, young men have more years ahead of them, so when they take up a violent challenge, they are gambling with a greater proportion of their unlived lives. On mathematical grounds, one might expect the opposite, that as men's days are numbered, they can afford to become increasingly reckless, and a really old man might go on one last spree of rape and murder until a SWAT team cuts him down. One reason this does not happen is that men always have the option of investing in their children, grandchildren, nieces and nephews, so older men, who are physically weaker but socially and economically stronger, have more to gain in providing for and protecting their families than in siring more offspring. The other is that dominance in humans is a matter of reputation, which can be self-sustaining with a long payout. Everyone loves a winner, and nothing succeeds like success. So it is in the earliest rounds of competition that the reputational stakes are highest. Testosterone, then, prepares men, and to a lesser extent women, for contests of dominance. It doesn't cause violence directly, because many kinds of violence have nothing to do with dominance, and because many contests of dominance are settled by displays and brinkmanship rather than violence itself. But to the extent that the problem of violence is a problem of young, unmarried, lawless men competing for dominance, whether directly or on behalf of a leader, then violence really is a problem of there being too much testosterone in the world. The socially constructed nature of dominance can help explain which individuals are most likely to take risks to defend it. Perhaps the most extraordinary popular delusion about violence of the past quarter century is that it is caused by low self-esteem. That theory has been endorsed by dozens of prominent experts, has inspired school programs designed to get kids to feel better about themselves, and in the late 1980s, led the California legislature to form a task force to promote self-esteem. Yet Baumeister has shown that the theory could not be more spectacularly, hilariously, achingly wrong. Violence is a problem not of too little self-esteem, but of too much, particularly when it is unearned. Self-esteem can be measured, and surveys show that it is the psychopaths, street toughs, bullies, abusive husbands, serial rapists, and hate crime perpetrators who are off the scale. Diana Scully interviewed many rapists in their prison cells who bragged to her that they were multi-talented superachievers. Psychopaths and other violent people are narcissistic. They think well of themselves, not in proportion to their accomplishments, but out of a congenital sense of entitlement. When reality intrudes, as it inevitably will, they treat the bad news as a personal affront, and its bearer, who is endangering their fragile reputation, as a malicious slanderer. Violence-prone personality traits are even more consequential when they infect political rulers, because their hang-ups can affect hundreds of millions of people rather than just the unlucky few who live with them or cross their paths. Unimaginable amounts of suffering have been caused by tyrants who callously presided over the immiseration of their peoples or launched destructive wars of conquest. In chapters 5 and 6, we saw that the wars and decamega murderers of the 20th century can be attributed in part to the personalities of just three men: tinpot tyrants like Saddam Hussein, Mobutu Sese Seko, Muammar Gaddafi, Robert Mugabe, Idi Amin, Jean Bedel Bokassa, and Kim Jong-il, have immiserated their people on a scale that is smaller but still tragic. The study of the psychology of political leaders, to be sure, has a deservedly poor reputation. It's impossible to test the object of investigation directly, and all too tempting to pathologize people who are morally contemptible. Psychohistory also has a legacy of fanciful psychoanalytic conjectures about what made Hitler, Hitler. He had a Jewish grandfather. He had only one testicle. He was a repressed homosexual. He was asexual. He was a sexual fetishist. As the journalist Ron Rosenbaum wrote in Explaining Hitler, "The search for Hitler has apprehended not one coherent consensus image of Hitler, but rather many different Hitlers, competing Hitlers, conflicting embodiments of competing visions. Hitlers who might not recognize each other well enough to say, Heil, if they came face to face in hell." For all that, the more modest field of personality classification, which pigeonholes rather than explains people, has something to say about the psychology of modern tyrants. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM, of the American Psychiatric Association, defines narcissistic personality disorder as a pervasive pattern of grandiosity, need for admiration, and a lack of empathy. Like all psychiatric diagnoses, narcissism is a fuzzy category and overlaps with psychopathy, a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others, and with borderline personality disorder, instability in mood, black and white thinking, chaotic and unstable interpersonal relationships, self-image, identity, and behavior. But the trio of symptoms at narcissism's core, grandiosity, need for admiration, and lack of empathy, fits tyrants to a T. It is most obvious in their vainglorious moments, hagiographic iconography, and obsequious mass rallies. And with armies and police forces at their disposal, narcissistic rulers leave their mark in more than statuary. They can authorize vast outlays of violence. As with garden variety bullies and toughs, the unearned self-regard of tyrants is eternally vulnerable to being popped. So any opposition to their rule is treated not as criticism, but as a heinous crime. At the same time, their lack of empathy imposes no break on the punishment they mete out to real or imagined opponents, nor does it allow any consideration of the human costs of another of their DSM symptoms, their fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, or ideal love, which may be realized in rapacious conquest, pharaonic construction projects, or utopian master plans. And we have already seen what overconfidence can do in the waging of war. All leaders, of course, must have a generous dose of confidence to have become leaders. And in this age of psychology, pundits often diagnose leaders they don't like with narcissistic personality disorder. But it's important not to trivialize the distinction between a politician